Here, this is the private equity continuing to invest for growth and value creation. We've got a great group of panelists here, and moderating this is going to be Jason Osborne, partner at Winston & Strawn. So, Jason, take it away.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Hopefully, this will be a lively and engaging panel. We recognize that we are the last panel holding you back from lunch, so we will try to keep this as timely as we can. As Eric mentioned, I'm a partner at Winston & Strawn in our private equity group here in New York. And I'll turn to Jack and let him lead off the introductions for the rest of the panel.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. Jack Bernstein with Monroe Capital. Monroe is a private credit platform. Today we manage about $16 billion in assets. It's diversified across a number of different strategies, all in and around credit and asset management on the debt side. Primarily what we do, though, our bread and butter is middle market direct lending to both private equity and non-sponsored transactions.
I'm Colin Sinclair. I'm a partner in the M&A group at Paul Weiss. I focus primarily on private equity transactions, everything from buyouts to joint ventures to minority investments across industries.
I'm David Nykrug, CEO of Optimate. I think of us, most of our clients do, as operating partners for HR operations. We support clients throughout the M&A lifecycle, pre-deal due diligence, day one readiness, and post-day one synergies. We focus solely in the HR work stream, so benefits, retirement plans, payroll, and HR systems. And we leave everything else to all the other vendors out there.
And to wrap up, my name is Ben Hotz. I'm a principal at Blackstone. I sit within our growth strategy where we partner with high growth businesses. I've been investing in private equity for nearly 10 years now, and so excited to speak with you all.
Excellent. Well, I want to start with a little bit of a table setting exercise. So I've been on this panel a couple of times in the past, and it's safe to say I think that 2023 has been a very different year than last year or the year before. So just to give the audience a sense of what you guys have been living through the last couple quarters, Ben, maybe you could start and just tell me what your experience has been this year so far.
Yeah, it's been, I think, candidly unprecedented. The shape of the deals that we are currently seeing in the market is much different than that of the peak valuation environments in 21 and 22. And so, I think increasingly being selective around the geographies and the markets in which these companies play, the profitability profile, and the way that the company's been operated historically, and just maintaining discipline in our investment approach has been paramount. Because, you know, the volatile market environment, we've seen it before in previous cycles, is there's been winners and losers, and so just remaining disciplined has been one of the core tenets of our approach.
David?
Unfortunately, we've been seeing a lot of cleanup work from the expedited, I would say, due diligence cycles that we've been seeing. We need to call some operating partners and, you know, with two questions: A, who did the due diligence, and B, was the stock or an asset deal? Kind of like deja vu from 09 to 2014, where we were just seeing, you know, all these things that were happening. Now we have to figure out how to clean them up. And personally, I would prefer seeing offense work, process improvement work versus the cleanup work that we're seeing.
Echoing a lot of what Ben said, I've seen sponsor clients very, you know, disciplined in their approach. Tighter money in the lending markets, particularly, is, you know, put pressure on returns, and so it's much more important to get each investment right. But at the same time, figuring out how to deploy capital in that environment has led to a lot of creativity and different structures and investment theses.
Yeah, I mean, to put it simply, there's just more discovery going on both the price, valuation, and diligence side. The bar is higher. There's not as much of a rush or need to get deals done quickly. It's not as aggressive as a market, so people are really taking their time. There's also still the gap between valuation expectations and where the financing markets are, which I know we're going to get into, and so that's just frankly led to deals not even getting done on the new LBO side, so which is a lot of what we lend to. From our platform, so a lot of what we're doing are more opportunistic financings around dividends, if we are willing to provide that, if the, you know, situation supports it, recapitalizations, refinancings. A lot of people did a lot of, you know, unnatural things during COVID, and people were just looking to get their deals done quickly, so maybe it's replacing lenders who, you know, aren't fit for the credit right now and can't maybe grow or do something, you know, in this environment where they were before. So just a lot of things like that, and check sizes generally have come down given the difficult fundraising environment.
Got it. You know, we're almost 5 minutes in, and I'm going to go off script for the first time. So I made it 5 minutes. I want to piggyback on this question a little bit because I want to explore the topic of seller reluctance. So what I'm hearing from a lot of my private equity clients is that they're in processes and they feel like they're not getting a lot of information from the sellers. They feel like, Jack, to your point, there's really no sense of urgency the way there has been over the last couple of years. And Colin, I'll put you on the spot. In your practice, are you getting the sense that sellers are avoiding selling into the trough and that's limiting deal flow, or do you think it's something else?
I think there's a little bit of that going on, but I also think it's especially smart sellers, if you're confident enough in a company to run a process in this environment, I think they're being much more structured about what information they're providing and when. And so knowing the impact that a sale process can have on a company, wanting to avoid spending management time on something that's not actually going to get done, making sure they have real buyers who are credible, who have either, you know, enough equity that they can write a check or able to actually raise debt in this environment, you know, limiting the process down, focusing people on the value drivers, and then sort of at the last minute opening up fulsome due diligence, but only you know, for people who really have shown that they can put their best foot forward and actually get a deal done.
I would add to that, I mean, even as difficult of an environment as this is with kind of the valuation gap, it's still a very imbalanced supply and demand type of situation where if you're a good company, a good credit, everyone's going to flock to that, and so you're still going to get premium terms. And so in this environment, if you know that, kind of to my earlier point, you kind of know you can take your time and really be thoughtful about who you go out to and who you give information to because you are pretty well coveted, even more so in this environment than ever before.
Yeah, I might just add one other thing, which is maybe a personal point of view, but I find that there's a dichotomy of business quality coming out to market where there's exceptional assets that are still warranting premium multiples. And in that case, if the company comes out to market and doesn't get the valuation they're looking for, current owners are happy to hold because they know it's a good business and they're willing to wait and be patient. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have more desperate businesses that, buyers are understanding of the asset quality and you have your own set of circumstances there. But there's not really a middle ground right now, which is just creating an interesting environment.
Jack, I'm going to turn to you for the next question. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of the rising acquisition finance costs and the reduced debt availability that we've seen?
Yeah, so it's made the math harder, as a lot of the prior panels have talked about. When a lot of what we do are private equity backed transactions, we do non-sponsored deals too. But given all the money that's been raised in the private equity space over the past 10 years, that's really where a majority of our businesses flock to. We kind of go with the market, and those transactions are highly dependent on raising a substantial amount of debt to fund them, and so. Lenders have pulled back more quickly than I think valuation expectations have, and so there's that gap there. And you also have a lot of we compete. We're a private credit kind of senior lender, and so we compete with banks a lot of times. And so on one hand, they've pulled back, and it's created opportunity for us to come in and finance deals at a lower LTV, lower leverage profile. But there's also so far we're willing to go as well. I mean, we're still kind of looking at a potential downturn and wanting to pull back a little bit, and so to make the math work and maybe fill that gap with junior capital or mezzanine capital, when those players come into the market, they're more naturally paired with a bank, and so on that hand, on that side, they're maybe crowded out a little bit from a unitranche product like we provide. So it's just made it tougher. Either deals don't get done, or they're just more creative structures. I'd also say on the existing portfolio, we're seeing the effects, and I think back to like a Warren Buffett quote where he says, it's only when the tide goes out when you realize who's been swimming naked. And it's been true with a lot of our capital structures being exposed now because we're a floating rate product. And so, we fund a lot of buy and build strategies where they're very much debt financed, and that all goes well when costs are low and valuations are going up. And, you could fund a lot of acquisitions just using debt. But when, the market turns like it has and rates go up and, you know, cash flow is tight and, you know, your debt costs are higher, it really puts pressure on these companies from a liquidity standpoint, and we're having to deal with a lot of amendments and modifications with our partners, our private equity partners, on deals where it's a little bit of an outsized, you know, disproportionate balance sheet from a debt to equity standpoint, and that's never really been as much of an issue before.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to your point on what are the structures that people are using in these situations, I've certainly seen a lot recently of transactions where people are trying to come up with a way to roll the existing debt, especially if it's on, you know, helpful terms to the company, and whether that's, you know, cutting a deal with the lender or even, you know, structuring a deal that in, you know, 2021 would have been a full buyout, you know, leaving, you know, doing a 50-50 deal where the seller retains, you know, a pretty significant go-forward stake in order to prevent a change of control under the debt documents. So lots of structures like that being, you know, looked at and executed.
Yeah, not much to add.
Got it. All right, so Ben, I'll turn to you. So what investment strategies are evolving for private equity funds in the hunt for greater returns?
Yeah, you know, I thought a lot about this. I think the basic tenet of your question is, how is our business transforming to meet our desired outcome? And in a volatile market, you know, every industry is facing this question. And in the case of private equity, I think it's important to remember that we've been through investment cycles before. I mentioned this before, but whether it's 2001, the dot-com bubble, 2008, 2009, the Great Recession, and now in 2023, 2024. I think the difference this time around, though, is the modern form of private equity has been around for nearly 50 years. And so our ability to pattern recognize, leverage lessons learned from the past is greater than it's ever been. And so with that in mind, I see two emerging trends. We can cover this in greater detail, and we've mentioned it a few times, but I think investors are being incredibly thoughtful about where they sit in the capital structure. And private equity, I think, sits at a unique vantage point vis-a-vis most other asset managers, in that we have a unique ability to pick and choose and be selective around positively skewed risk-reward profiles. So, you know, we can cover that a little bit later. But the second, and one I'm personally passionate about, is the emergence of technology and data to drive better investment practices. We're an investor in a business called Dynamo Software that provides middle office, back office, and front office software to the alternative asset management industry. And during our diligence, one of the standout observations was the exceptional retention profile of that business. And ultimately, what that meant was that the platform was driving a growing amount of value for our investors and our customers. And so it was a very tangible data point that the investment community is doing whatever it can to leverage data and technology to drive operational efficiency, streamline administrative burden, so that the investors can spend the lion's share of their time driving towards the desired outcome, which in this case is driving strong returns for limited partners.
Anyone else on the panel want to?
Well, I think the interesting piece about, you know, a more mature industry is that we're also seeing increased asset management M&A, which private equity firms doing balance sheet deals and acquiring other asset managers, and, you know, whether that's in sort of an emerging market like the private credit space, trying to build that strategy through inorganic growth rather than growing a team in-house, or, you know, just other strategies that they think their LPs are interested in that they may not have an offering for. So that's definitely something I think we've started to see, you know, this year already, and probably something that's likely to continue.
Absolutely. Well, Ben, to your point, there are investment cycles, and we have seen this, at least some of us in this room have seen this before, and I remember distinctly in 2009 being very concerned that deals just weren't going to get done anymore, and representing private equity funds was suddenly a very scary proposition. But of course, intelligent people with a lot of money to put to work find ways to do it, and people rolled up their sleeves and found new and creative strategies. Now, it was a lot harder to deploy capital in 2009 and 2010, but I think ultimately those vintages did much better than the vintages immediately prior to that. So David, I'm going to turn to you now. What strategies are sponsors leveraging to increase portfolio value?
So traditionally, organizations are focused on everything they know within the organization, you know, looking at headcount reductions, consolidation of operations, and relocation to lower cost locales. However, what we've seen is a lot of momentum is building for different approaches. whether it's because of employee relations issues, PR, as well as they've already done it, they've done everything else. Different approaches that are gaining popularity are GPOs, similar to CoreTrust and some of the others, consolidating vendors, whether it's legal services, IT services, accounting and tax. In our world, our clients, you know, are focused on HR and benefits, whether it's payroll vendors, health plans, retirement plans. But you're also seeing, you know, contract management, auditing of invoices versus contracts, as well as reviewing SLAs. At the end of the day, it's plugging the leakage anywhere you can find it. Now, what we're seeing, and we talk about portfolios here, we talk about sponsors, right? But this also applies to family offices and strategics who have, you know, sit with 20, 30 companies that they never bothered thinking about putting together. Some of them do voluntary, you know, someone mentioned earlier the Berkshire Hathaway model, if I may, versus the Carl Icahn model, which is you can't buy a box of paper clips without their blessing. So you look at that from that perspective. But that's what we're seeing is saying, okay, we've done the usual, we know the game plan, now let's figure out what else can we do and how can we do it from a different approach.
Absolutely. I think one trend that we saw starting to pick up probably about 10 or 15 years ago, but which I think now at this point is almost universal, is at the very least use of operating partners by private equity funds to bring in industry-specific knowledge and best practices to help leverage the knowledge of the PE firm with respect to their portfolio companies, and also a number of private equity sponsors bringing entire consulting arms that are, I don't want to say plug and play because that's too simplistic, but are almost plug and play in terms of bringing best practices across their portfolio.
Yeah, and it's a balancing act because you can say, okay, you can go in and say, hey, everybody use XYZ law firm, but at the end of the day, I would say in our world, we spend probably 50 to 60% of our time dealing with shuttle diplomacy and change management, getting people to that strategy, right? It's everyone wants their own control. They want to deal with that. They may not understand the full benefits or they're, you know, worried about other things, so that's something.
We're actually doing that a lot on our side as a lender, too, in unfortunate situations where, you know, like I said earlier, there is a disproportionate balance sheet with too much debt on it, and, you know, the natural kind of reaction from guys like us would be, well, you know, de-lever us and pay us down and put in more equity, but we don't want to have that heavy-handed approach with our private equity partners because then we wouldn't do new business and we don't want to take over these companies. We just want to go back to our seat as a lender and kind of, you know, be along for the ride that we signed up for. And so a lot of the times, instead of, you know, requiring that kind of deleveraging event, we'll send in a financial advisor or someone who to represent our interest just to check things and make sure that, you know, we're okay continuing to kick the can down the road or back, you know, the current plan, just to, you know, as an option for us to feel good about the credits that we're still in.
The next question we have on our list is about the growing gap between vendor and buyer pricing expectations. Now, we touched on this a little bit, and I think the comment that Jack, you and Ben both made was there are high-quality assets out there that are still commanding a premium, and I think we're certainly seeing that. I had a private equity client come to me and say, hey, look, we just set in three bids that we felt really good about, and we got blown out of the water. And sitting in the interest rate environment that we're in, I think a lot of people were surprised by that. And to be clear, they did not get blown out by strategics. They got blown out by other private equity funds. So let me ask a fundamental question. Is there really a gap, or is there not?
A gap in
evaluation expectations.
You know, I think it depends on what's going on in the market. It's a very kind of headline-driven market right now, and volatility, I think, it leads to that imbalance. But, you know, if you've people are feeling good about the future and, you know, whether it's to the good side or the bad side, I think then, you know, buyers and sellers can kind of coalesce around evaluation. But, you know, to what Ben said earlier, I mean, the good deals are getting done still at high valuations and tight terms, and it really depends, you know, what that private equity firm is underwriting and how their portfolio, from a return standpoint, how their portfolio is structured. There are more value-oriented private equity firms that, you know, are doing 10 deals and know that six of them might not go well, but four will return the whole fund. And then there are ones that are more balanced and diverse and are willing to pay a higher price and kind of, you know, have a more, you know, conservative, but, you know, healthy return that's acceptable to them. So that my opinion on it.
Yeah, all I would add is, like, I think that there's still some nostalgia from 2021, 2022 that takes some time to unlearn, that sellers are still anchored towards, you know, their entry price and what they thought that this company was going to exit for. So I still see a gap, and I think it's just going to take some time. It's not, perhaps there's some structural nature to it, but that's what I would add.
Excellent. Well, Colin, we'll turn to you next. Can you talk to us a little bit about how people are using rep and warranty insurance to do no indemnity deals?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still think, you know, even in today's, especially actually in today's environment, rep and warranty insurance is a really powerful tool for sponsors to get deals done and sort of offer certainty to sellers, you know, and being able to say, look, we may not have hit the pricing expectation that you had when you entered this company, you know, 5 years ago, but we're going to allow you to walk away. We're not going to leave, you know, contingent liabilities hanging over your head. I think that, you know, while in 21 it was a helpful way to sort of differentiate yourself maybe from a strategic buyer, now it's sort of a way to say, look, let's, you know, we're going to help you out here. We're going to let you get a clean break. And one thing that the sort of lower deal flow has generated is cheaper policies and more competition between the rep and warranty insurers because, you know, in 21, in the first half of 22, the insurers were really building out their underwriting teams, building out their capacity to take on risk. And, you know, as the deal flow slowed down, you know, they still had that capacity without necessarily the deal flow to fill it. So we're seeing today sponsors being able to drive, you know, better terms with the policies in terms of, you know, zero retention on fundamental reps, you know, lower deductibles, lower premiums. So definitely something that, you know, we still see really across the board in PE deals.
Yeah, it's certainly a nice change of pace. From what we've seen the last couple of years, where you call up the brokers and they tell you that all the carriers are fully allocated for the year and are done, and you're sitting there in October trying to figure out how to get your deal done.
Yeah, much better to create some competitive tension.
For sure, absolutely. Anything else that people are seeing in terms of deal structures, be it earnouts, significant rollover stakes, maybe higher than what we've seen in the past, other structures that people are using to bridge the gap, where maybe they can't hit the headline value, but they can take away some of the risk on the downside to help get sellers comfortable?
We actually worked on a sell-side deal where we took back a pretty significant stake of the purchase price in a preferred stock. It was a private equity seller, public company, strategic buyer, and you know that was a way that we helped to bridge the gap was created a new preferred that they used to, you know, partially fund the deal. So we ended up with a, you know, this is obviously the PE firm would prefer to fully exit, but this was a way to help them get the headline that they were looking for, you know, with a fairly structured product that was, you know, I think a little bit of discomfort on both sides doing something that they weren't necessarily used to doing, but getting creative to try to get a deal done at a valuation that made sense.
I'm not seeing as much change on like the full buyout side. You know, it's always been a kind of consistent mix of cash equity and rollover and, you know, earnout and stuff like that, at least from what I'm seeing. But seeing more minority deals and other types of capital raises that, you know, outside of a full kind of, you know, buyout.
Absolutely. All right, Ben, we'll turn back to you. Can you tell us a little bit about using partnerships and co-investing in structured equity investments to remain flexible and creative?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it goes to Jack's point, but you know, the structured equity and partnerships is not a novel concept, but it is something that we're seeing a ton of opportunity in both. And the reason for that is, you know, well, taking a step back, as private equity investors, you need to remain consistent and disciplined in your investment approach, but while also avoiding complacency. Because this is a crowded and competitive market, so it's crucial that you're continuously innovating and thinking creatively. Now, one of the primary feeders into private equity is the VC community. That's where a lot of deals come from, and you know, coming off of a record-setting capital deployment year, which was driven by both high valuation expectations and just the abundance of capital in the market that perpetuated a positive feedback loop that companies should grow at all costs. Against that backdrop, with the interest rate environment that we're seeing in the public and the public markets that are asking companies to drive towards profitability, that's creating a wild amount of complexities within companies and factors and incentives that's making it difficult for buyers and sellers to find common ground. And so mechanisms like structured equity instruments that can help you bridge towards a valuation that makes everyone happy, or even more creative mechanisms like joint ventures, are becoming increasingly relevant in the market right now. And so, I'll echo what Jack said. We see even a greater portion of those types of deals than straight down the fairway buyouts or, you know, minority investments, 1x lick pref type deal.
Anyone else? Okay. All right, Colin, turning back to you. Wondering about understanding the impact of increased cost potentials during a drawn out deal.
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about this earlier in terms of sellers trying to manage these processes and keep them tight in order to kind of minimize the risk of a broken deal, because I think the risk of deals drawing out lands a little bit disproportionately on the sell side, because, you know, both buyers and sellers, if you have a deal that takes a really long time to get signed or closed, are going to bear costs, associated with advisors and, you know, the time spent. But I think the sell side is going to, you know, have a distracted management team trying to get deals done, respond to requests for information, you know, basically take a lot of time out of their day-to-day job of running the company in terms of like trying to facilitate an M&A process instead, which is not what their sort of bread and butter is. And so, you know, I think that's why we're seeing the sell side try to tighten up these processes as much as possible in order to minimize that risk of distracting management and then having to go back to the drawing board with a company that may be seen as damaged goods if you couldn't get a deal done, or just, you know, time lost when you could have been building the business. So that's you know, I think goes to that point that we were making earlier.
And are you guys seeing the timelines getting extended? I mean, there are certainly specific deals that you can look at, specific types of deals, right? There was an article yesterday about how SPAC deals are now taking twice as long to get through the SEC and close. But in the private equity space, are you seeing deal timelines extend as a result of uncertainty in the marketplace or otherwise?
I think you're seeing, in two ways. I think one is you see a lot of deals are taking a little bit longer to sign than they would have when the environment was so frothy, because people are spending a little bit more time on due diligence. They're not willing to just, you know, kind of pay a price that they can justify based on the cheap debt. The returns are tighter, more pressure on the model, and so I think people are focusing a little bit more on making sure that the math all works. And then we have also been seeing, we actually haven't touched on this, but the antitrust environment has been putting pressure on deals as well in terms of, you know, timelines from signing to closing. You know, you're getting reviewed on a lot of deals now that, you know, under prior administrations maybe would have just sort of breezed through, given the kind of heightened enforcement environment and the priorities of the agencies. So I think we're also seeing time spent on the front end, you know, working on strategy for antitrust, working on analysis, working on structures to help minimize the risk of a review and kind of an extended process, because especially once you get a deal signed, nobody wants to be sitting around for 15 months trying to get a deal cleared that has no kind of substantive risk. And so how do you avoid a second request? How do you, you know, make sure that you can get the agencies comfortable with these deals that, you know, if the analysis shows it shouldn't be a problem, you know, how do you kind of do advocacy to convey that?
You know, one thing we're seeing to help expedite the timeline as much as possible on the front end is we're now, as a lender, being contacted by the sell side banker who might have a debt advisory arm and saying, hey, we're coming to market with this asset. We haven't even gone to buyers yet, but would you take a look at it, give us a read or interest level, and, you know, sometimes even spend time with management to go through the credit so that they can then, when they go out to the market, say, we have an interested lender who's willing to do X or Y, and kind of speed that part up. Now, we're very kind of skeptical of those situations because we don't want to put out like a staple financing kind of, you know, letter out there for someone else just to beat, because it's still very competitive, but we will help as much as we can, and I think that we're seeing a lot more of that, and, you know, on the front end, and also, you know, once a deal is kind of under exclusivity, buyers hiring third parties to kind of do the financing and take that off their plate so they can focus on the M&A side and kind of dovetail those two timelines and, you know, get both done quicker. So it's a change.
Ben, David, any thoughts on timeline?
Yeah, I would say that I think sellers are conscious of the fact that it's a subtle point, but buyers are actually incentivized to elongate. Like, the more data you have, the longer it takes to fund, the bigger the business grows, that helps your IRR calc. So I think that sellers are continuously pushing, like, let's get this done, because they're conscious of there's a, you know, reverse incentives on the other side.
The only thing, we've been involved with a couple of situations where they know there's a piece of a business that's going to drag the entire deal down, and we've gone and just, they want to carve it out. They'll keep that, get rid of the sexy part, for lack of a better term, and then sell the other one later, do something else with it.
Got it. Well, Colin, I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole on the antitrust side, but I think this is something that's coming up much more frequently, even in private equity backed deals, where, you know, for the longest time, particularly with private equity buyers, you go into a deal, there'd be minimal antitrust risk, you get early termination and you were done. 2 years ago, early termination came off the table. Now we're seeing the FTC and the DOJ take more and more aggressive positions on deals. I think you're seeing the same thing I am, where there seems to be no antitrust risk at all. How do you counsel your clients proactively to go into a deal and manage that risk? Are you telling them, hey, look, hire the economist now, get the work done now, and go to the FTC proactively? Or are you counseling them to be more reactionary?
It totally depends on the situation, because I think in a lot of deals, we're still seeing situations where, you know, there's a portfolio company, existing portfolio company, if you're on, say you're on the buy side, existing portfolio company maybe has a little bit of vertical overlap, but no real substantive issues under the antitrust laws. So in a situation like that, you know, where we really believe that there is no second request potential, it's more about, maybe we don't hire the economist, but we sort of take steps to formulate the arguments. And I've started to involve the antitrust teams in deals much earlier than I think we would have done in prior years, where, you know, you would do that in a strategic deal where everyone can kind of see, okay, we're combining, you know, top three players in an industry, so we know we're going to have some issues here. But in deals with low risk, we're still starting to do that, develop an antitrust strategy, figure out what we can give in terms of, you know, if there's a reverse break fee, if there's a, you know, what standard of efforts you're willing to agree to try to get the deal done, what's the outside date in terms of how long do you have to try to get it done, and, you know, preparing yourself for a sort of low risk event, but being ready for it if it does come to pass.
Great. So David, turning back to the process, how does digging deeper during the process benefit the long-term value creation?
Well, we all agree that, you know, more time means more information, right? Higher confidence in the finances, better understanding of the organization. Unfortunately, the due diligence time allocation continues to be, you know, minutes, day, you know, not days and weeks. Historically, right, what was the assumption? We know the industry, we can fix it, right? How bad could it really be? Or if it's a real disaster, we always have reps and warranties. However, what we're seeing is when reality sets in, the messes are impacting EBITDA. There's sort of this black hole that we're seeing, is that there's a mess, not bad enough to go to reps and warranties, and what do you do with it, especially in situations where it may not be as profitable as you intended it to be, and you're stuck with it from that side of it. But one, in our world, right, one frequent area that we're seeing or not enough time is given to during the due diligence process is the HR work stream. This is the benefits, the HR systems, and things of that nature. Especially in the healthcare sector, corporate practice and medicine sort of, you know, butts heads with ERISA and other things. You know, there's greater opportunity to avoid the potential landmines that are out there, and it doesn't need, you know, people don't need to spend weeks on it. It's a matter of get a couple of the right phone calls in, the right requests, the right data into the data room. The goal is to create a comprehensive picture within the HR infrastructure. What, you know, no different than you're dealing with IT, manufacturing, or distribution. This is what we're seeing. We're just seeing whether it's the forgotten stepchild or something else around it. based on our experience with our clients, with our clients and other sponsors, right? An ounce of prevention goes a long way with what's going on. The more you know, the better off you are, is what we're seeing. And it's time and time again that we're just seeing it. And it's, some days it's scary, but that's from our world. Just give it another day and guess, and you'll be in a different place.
Absolutely. Well, look, I want to bookend our initial question where we were talking about where we've been over the last couple of quarters and talk about where we're going. So I'd invite each of you to kind of look into your crystal ball. And have we reached that point now where interest rates are leveling off? I think no one's expecting them to go down anytime soon, but it looks like they're not going to go up any further. We've finally, you know, managed to get a deal on the debt ceiling being raised, so that uncertainty and that externality have been taken out. It seems like hopefully things are going to moderate over the next couple of quarters. And I feel like over the last year, I've been told many, many times by many market participants, we're about 3 months away from things really picking up again. And here we are about 12 to 15 months into that. Is this finally the point where we are 3 months away from things picking up again and going back to 2021, maybe? Jack, you want to go for it? Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say the same thing. Everyone says it's going to get, it's going to pick up, it's going to get busier. You know, I think people are still holding out hope that rates might go back down, and you know, the times of 2022 and 2021 will be back. I don't think that we believe that. So I think it'll be kind of like a higher for longer interest rate environment, but hopefully stable, and valuations in the private market will adjust, and deals will get done because, you know, there's both buyers and sellers that need to sell that have been holding off and will have pressure to do so from timeline standpoints, and a lot of dry powder on the buy side. And so at some point, I think that's got to be deployed, and assets have to be exchanged. And so we're holding out hope. It's just taking longer than we expected.
Yeah, and I think, you know, piggybacking off of that, one area in particular where I think we might start to see more activity is on the take private space, because boards are, you know, who may have been holding out hope over the past 12 months may be starting to get the message that the pressure on their stock price is secular, and it's they're not going to go see those levels that they were seeing in 21. And so maybe now is a time where, you know, a price to, you know, they can find a price to sell that's not at the 52-week high, because they may have kind of confidence in hearing from their financial advisors that they're not going to reach those heights again. And so it may be possible to start bridging that valuation gap that I think has kind of put a damper on those types of deals recently.
David, what's next?
I'll leave it to you guys, the crystal ball here. I mean, we see it from the operational side day in and day out. Our deal, I think people are getting smarter when they do the deals, and that's really going to help facilitate future expansion.
Yeah, and I'd say that it's a simple but important point from an investment perspective that, you know, the better, you know, confidence you have in what the future will look like gives you greater ability to underwrite the deal today. And so with how much change went on over the last 12 months, and hopefully you're right that even with a stable yet high interest rate, the fact that you know that for at least the short to medium term helps with gaining confidence and momentum. So I actually see it, the deal volume picking up now. I think the jury's still out on whether those ultimately get over the finish line. So we'll see.
Absolutely. Well, I'm seeing much the same thing. It's interesting. In the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've seen more action in the pipeline than I've seen in the last 2 to 3 months. So I think we are finally at that point where maybe we're a couple of months away from it picking back up. So we've got some questions rolling in. So we'll start with the first one. Aside from in due diligence, how, if at all, is ESG changing the way you approach investment opportunities? Anyone want to volunteer for that one?
I mean, for us, it's just another diligence work stream now that we have to do on every deal, and we use third party to do it. So it's a cost, just an added cost to getting a deal done. And you know, this third party that we use, they're not looking to kill the deal in any way, and we won't let that dictate kind of, you know, in a vacuum if we're going to move forward or not. But it is something that we need to show our LPs that we're considering, and so it's definitely been introduced to our process on every deal now.
It's a short point because there's a lot of complexity with ESG, but I think historically it's been considered a risk, where it's like, okay, what's the damage this business is doing from an ESG perspective? I think that talk track is flipping to what's the opportunity, that companies that are actually proactive about this have outsized opportunities going forward. So I do think the talk track, just ESG more broadly, is shifting.
All right, the second question is, what are you doing on the portfolio monitoring post-transaction to maintain or create value?
I'll take it from here, from under this perspective. So there are a couple of different approaches here. You know, historically, you can do, you know, if you do nothing, you're going to have your expenses go up regardless of what the work stream that they're in. In terms of portfolio monitoring, either leveraging your internal operational team, your operating partners are outsourcing it. Post-transactions, you know, you're looking at, all right, what do you need to do, what you need to accomplish? What was the intended value? Well, what were the synergistic opportunities that you were proposing, and what's the dichotomy to where it is today? There are some firms, right, such as ourselves, that we do end-to-end. There are other types of audit firms that are out there that are focused, whether it's in IT today, whether we spoke about earlier this morning around cyber, focusing around that. We're seeing a lot of time and energy being put in, not just initially, but ongoing. So it's all a matter of the trifecta of, do you want to do it internally? Do you want to outsource it to the sponsor? Or do you want to outsource it to a third party, is what we're seeing across the board, depending on the culture of the organization.
I'd add to that it's a little bit of a different answer. It's a different question, an answer to a different question, but historically, value creation and portfolio monitoring, like almost by accident, 90% of your time is spent with the 10% of assets that are more challenged and trying to find ways to reorient those investments. And now increasingly, I'll go back to technology or other more proactive monitoring. That's not an excuse for not spending time with your outperformers to go create outsized returns for your investors. So I think rebalancing across the portfolio with the resources that you have is something that we've been spending a lot of time thinking about.
Yeah. Taking off the fire hats sooner and focus the ones that aren't on fire.
The last question that we have so far is input on put call option mechanics for management rollover, which came in anonymously, so we don't know which side of the table they're on.
Yeah, I'm happy to speak to that. I think, when you see management rolling over real dollars, oftentimes private equity firms will want to have the ability to, buy out managers if they've left the company, even if they're a good lever, just based on the premise that you don't want to have someone in your cap table in a private company who's no longer involved with the business. But if you have management rolling over real dollars rather than, incentive equity, there's a lot of... Oftentimes they will agree to that, but they may have, difficulty accepting it, saying, look, I've essentially made an investment here. I should be able to ride the upside even if I'm no longer with the company. And so sometimes you see, you can only buy back the shares if it's a for-cause termination, pressure on the pricing, making sure that they're getting fair market value, they're not getting cut down to cost pricing on a termination. Fairly unusual, I would say, for management to get put rights if they've left or been terminated. But depending on leverage or if it's a management team that is super valuable and they're looking at a lot of different options, possibly something they could negotiate for. Although I think again, people are pretty loath to agree to that.
So let me follow up with you on one point. We spend a lot of time negotiating these provisions. There are a lot of different ways to whack them. In your experience, how often are people actually buying out management from their actual invested dollars when they leave pre-liquidation?
I'd say it happens not irregularly. If the sponsor has allowed management to invest or they've required them to invest, my clients are, very involved with their portfolio companies, and if they see the management team not performing, you know, they're willing to make a change. And I think in that case, oftentimes they will, you know, do the repurchase. But it's, you know, it's one of the most important elements of it, because that often kind of gets lost in the sauce of, you know, we're doing a multi-billion-dollar transaction. You know, how much do we care about the management incentive program? But the answer is a lot, because, you know, all these businesses are run by individuals, and so making sure that the management team has the right incentive, and you also have the ability to monitor them appropriately and make sure that they're performing is critical.
Excellent. We have 5 seconds left. Does anybody want to leave us with one last pearl of wisdom? All right, we've wrenched it dry. Thank you, everybody, for coming to our panel. Enjoy lunch. Thank you to my panelists.
Thank you.